Has your life gotten boring? Are you looking for some excitement? Something a little unusual to brighten your day? You've come to the right place. Welcome to Out of the Ordinary on Mind's Eye Radio. I'm your host, Cole Hornaday. Mind's Eye Radio is a program tuned to the sounds of social change. It's written and produced by the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. In this hour, we'll look at unusual people and places, from the slightly odd to the truly bizarre. We'll visit a man who makes wooden hats and the inside of a poet's brain. We'll travel from Patagonia to Singapore, follow the making of an Onion newspaper article, and a few other exotic stops. Join us, won't you? As some of my favorite Onion newspaper headlines are, "Drugs Win Drug War," and "Princess Dies as She Lived, in Incredible Plushness." Kelly Warren looks into what goes into the making of an Onion story, Madison's popular satirical newspaper, or America's finest news source.
What is your Onion headline that stands out?
T-ball pitches perfect game at Special Olympics. It's mean, but it's funny. There was that one about the Bible salesman. It's filled with all sorts of profanity.
One of my favorite ones was back in the days of the Heaven Gate thing where they had, aliens arrive late. Hope no one killed themselves yet.
Certainly a favorite, perhaps the most outrageous, was Mother Teresa burns in hell through clerical error. I thought that was rather good.
Report, U.S. children lead world in hand-mouth coordination.
Every week for the last 11 years, the Onion newspaper has treated readers to some of the best humorous, political, and social satire. The 40-some page paper takes current issues, finds outlandish parallels elsewhere in the media, and creates a story that exploits such things as governmental waste, knee-jerk legislation, or a misplaced focus. Like the issue of May 13th, where the leading story titled "Tornado Violence, Are Tornadic Images in the Media to Blame?" compares the Littleton, Colorado shooting to the recent tornado destruction in Oklahoma.
Okay, you can think of this story as tornadoes are the kids, and tornado warnings and tornadic images in the media are Marilyn Manson and the video game Doom and so on. Now, the whole point of the story is to juxtapose those two ideas. The important things to get across are that, of course, much like the kids, tornadic images have no effect on the weather whatsoever.
Onion writer John Crusan was assigned the story, but before it even materialized, Crusan and the other staff writers, six men and two women, sat through a lengthy discussion on whether or not the tornado violence headline could support a story. Initially, managing editor Rob Siegel wasn't convinced it could.
But, I mean, obviously we all know that there is zero link between the behavior of a tornado and media images of tornadoes. So it doesn't even count as an exaggeration. There's an actual point where the reality is just severed altogether.
Head writer Todd Hansen made the biggest argument to run the story.
But people do say that maybe Marilyn Manson is responsible for the school shootings because the kids were into Marilyn Manson. And then they went psychotic and killed people, but that doesn't mean there's a cause and effect relationship. And so what you're doing is you're taking a case where there isn't a cause and effect relationship, and you're satirizing it by pointing out another case where there is also not a cause and effect relationship, but where it's more obvious that there's no cause and effect relationship.
Okay. I like the joke, but I'm thinking maybe the story exposes the joke's flaw.
I see.
All the while, Crusan is taking down the jokes that will clarify the parallels and drive the humor home.
You can see you expect this kind of devastation of an entire neighborhood in an inner city, in an urban environment. But this is out in America's heartland, in the middle of Oklahoma, in the middle of good Christian, a conservative community. And the joke being that obviously tornadoes only happen on the Great Plains because that's the only place where they're.
Here are segments of the final version that appeared in the May 13th issue of The Onion. Tornado violence. Are tornadic images in the media to blame?
It's been almost 2 weeks now, but life still hasn't returned to normal for the residents of this central Oklahoma town. It probably never will. On May 3rd, Dell City and its surrounding area was shattered by a shocking act of violence that took 41 lives, not to mention this peaceful farming community's collective innocence. "This sort of thing isn't supposed to happen here," said Dell City resident Bud Swearingen, gazing at the mound of rubble and debris that was once his home. "Maybe in Bangladesh or some other far-off place, but not here in America's heartland." Like so many of those caught in their path, the killer tornadoes have died, fading away on the Oklahoma plains. But the questions remain. How could this happen? Why didn't anyone see it coming? What would drive an air mass to commit such a horrible act of violence? For many, the blame lies with the media.
The subtext is that you have to have someone saying, a voice of reason, who is stooping to the level of talking to people who think that tornadoes are influenced by things they see. And all the people who think by correlation that when kids see someone die in a video game or they hear violent lyrics by Marilyn Manson, that alone can push them over the edge.
"Every day in this country, we are bombarded with images of powerful, destructive wind vortices," said Ronald Gilchrist, director of the Princeton University Center for Media Studies. According to Gilchrist, TV news programs only exacerbate the problem, reinforcing tornado behavior by giving them the attention they crave. "Whenever a tornado threatens to strike, it's the lead story on the news," Gilchrist said. "That only fosters that kind of violent behavior and increases the odds of it recurring."
For nearly all Onion stories, the headlines are the joke, and the story explains the joke. John Cruson.
That's why in the first paragraph of any news story, and thus in our paper, it repeats the joke, and then it explains the joke just to death. And it's really hard to keep that interesting for a long time. That's why we're really proud that people seem to read the whole article, so at least the people that we'd want to hang out with and talk to.
John Cruson says that he and the other seven writers of The Onion strive to hold the paper to high standards.
We take it all very seriously, but it is something that we all really do believe in. We think it's as important as entertainment can get.
You can pick up weekly issues of The Onion in Madison, Milwaukee, Chicago, and Denver. And you can also find The Onion on the internet at www.theonion.com. And for all new headlines and stories, check out their new book, Our Dumb Century, edited by Scott Dickers. For Mind's Eye Radio, I'm Kelly Warren in Madison, Wisconsin.
Gustave Flaubert wrote, "Inside every notary's heart lies a poet." But what lies inside the poet's mind? Poet and songwriter Lynn Patrick Smith has an idea.
I think anyone would agree that poets are unusual people, even among other poets. And this is a look at the inside of a poet's brain. Discreetly, my brain cells are depleting themselves, not frantically, like shock therapy. They haven't scattered like a flock of scared sparrows or been asked to leave like unruly teenage children. I really did want them to stay. Some seem to have simply dozed off in front of some brainwave TV, leaving so unexpectedly they failed to have their affairs in order. Others chose silent suicides, swallowing that little secret agent pill, afraid they'd crack under pressure and their secrets, if revealed, might prove fatal. Some vanished like relatives I lost track of. Well, they might show up someday, slapping me on the back with their stories of the past that will clash so with my memories, I'll find it hard to imagine I shared a past with them. Anyway, they will be such loud, rude house guests, I'll wish they would just leave for good. Fortunately, I do have a reserve of brain cells to rely on, although lately some of them have become suspect. They ignore or only vaguely remember me, like I'm someone they sat behind in study hall years ago. Now they can't remember my name. I swear I faintly hear a group of them planning their escape, repeating, "Wait till he's asleep. Just wait till he's asleep."
Poetry is one way to go inside a human brain, but writer and director Rob Ferret of Madison discovered a more direct way of exploring the mind of an artist in his unusual radio drama.
Hey, Archie, how are ya?
Very well, thank you. Though you'll find that I answer to Mr. Leach much more cheerfully.
Oh, sure, yeah, whatever. Waitress, give me a big black coffee and a touchdown breakfast platter with bacon.
Great. And you, sir?
I would like 2 pieces of the double-layer devil's food cake, made all the more agreeable by its being a la mode, and with a healthy layer of whipped cream on top. An English breakfast tea would be just the thing to wash that down.
That'll be right out.
Thank you. Mr. Upton, it's a pleasure to meet you again. I appreciate your willingness to meet me at such a late hour.
Oh, that's no problem. I never get to bed before 5 a.m. I do most of my best work at night.
Oh, so do I. What sort of work do you do, Mr. Upton?
Well, I work in all sorts of different media. I'm quite versatile. I'm a polymath, really. So when I saw your ad offering grants and other support for eclectic and eccentric artists of a high caliber, well, I knew I was perfectly qualified, especially considering what passes for art in Madison. Have you seen the last couple of shows at the Art Center? Crap. Utter crap. But if I could get some kind of support and I could devote myself full time to producing and promoting my own work, I could revolutionize the art scene in this town.
Here you go. A touchdown and coffee for you, sir. And devil's food cake a la mode with tea for you.
Excellent. You've outdone yourself.
Excuse me, sir, but did I overhear you saying you were an artist?
Yeah, that's right. William Upton, artist of many talents.
Well, I don't know quite how to ask this, but, well, the cook and I have plenty of time on the night shifts, and, well, we do some painting and video and performance stuff, and I was wondering if you could take a look at it and give us some pointers.
Ah, I'm sorry. I'm in a meeting with this guy. I don't have time.
But, well, okay. Sorry to bother you.
Are you sure you don't want to see their work?
Oh, remember what I said about no talent amateurs? The only question is whether these kids are part of the Children with Big Eyes school or the heavy metal album cover school.
Nonetheless, part of the conditions of my grant support would be that the recipient helped me to determine the value and quality of pieces for my collection. It would be quite helpful to see you at work both as an artist and an appraiser.
Well, sure, Mr. Leach, but I'll tell you, we're wasting our time.
Excuse me, waitress.
Yes?
We've had a change of heart. Could you show us what you and your friend are working on?
Really? Great. Come on back here. Some of it's in the kitchen. I can't tell you how excited I am. We've been saying all along that we needed a real artist's input. This is so exciting.
Oh, yeah. No problem.
Some of our paintings are over there on the other side of the dishwasher. Sean, the cook, is in the basement working on a found art project. I'll go down and see if he's ready for you to look at it.
Now, let's see what we've got here.
You see? Look, I told you. It's heavy metal school. Howling demons, skeletons. There were kids in my high school who did stuff like this.
Okay. We're ready for you to come on down. Would you like some more coffee?
Yeah, I think I'll be needing it. I don't know about their art, but they make a pretty mean cup of coffee. What is that?
Well, this is kind of a found art 3D sort of visual thing. We've taken parts of the old bike rack outside and globbed on some dead mice and cigarette butts with a bunch of congealed grease from the grill.
Interesting. What's the title of this work?
Trish and I haven't decided for sure yet, but the working title is Dead Mice and Cigarette Butts Encased in Congealed Grease.
Elegant in its simplicity. Well, Mr. Upton, what is your opinion of this work? Overwhelmed to the point of speechlessness. Am I to accept this as an endorsement of this project?
Actually, Mr.
Leach, Archibald Leach, at your service.
Well, Mr. Leach, your friend can't talk because of the drug I put in his drink.
I see. And would that also account for his look of bewilderment, fatigue, and disorientation?
Yeah, it's this weird extract from the surgeon beetles of South America. It...
Yes, it leaves the victim conscious, but in a state of near total paralysis. I am, of course, familiar with the extract. Might I inquire as to why you've administered it to Mr. Upton here?
Well, it's like I said. We need him for our art projects.
Yeah, see, we try to do this reflexive, self-referential sort of thing. And we were thinking, well, why not include a real live artist in our art?
Or parts of him.
Right. And not live, I guess. I mean, he'll be dead before any of him is really incorporated into the project.
Hey, you don't have any kind of problem with this, do you? I mean, us poisoning your friend and cutting him up and all.
He's more of an acquaintance, really. I was hoping you'd let me stay to see you at work.
Great. This first thing we're going to do is actually a videotaped performance piece. We call it Exploring the Mind of an Artist. Turn on the camera, okay, Trish?
Rolling.
All right. Now, this performance piece will give us a look at the inner workings of the artistic mind. And we'll be able to examine just what makes Mr.
Upton.
Right. Mr. Upton here, whatever kind of guy he was. Plus, this will give us some great textures to add to the dead rats in grease sculpture.
What do you think, Mr. Leach?
I am more than impressed. It's unfortunate that talent such as yours is forced to work underground, both literally and figuratively.
Yeah, well, this isn't the sort of thing you can really apply for a grant for, you know?
On the contrary, it's entirely possible that you have been exploring the wrong avenues for funding. I am sure we could arrange some kind of generous stipend to allow you to continue your important work.
Oh, Sean, this is just the break we've been looking for.
Yeah, Mr. Leach, if you could give us a grant, well, I guarantee you, we won't let you down.
Well, listeners, if you will pardon me, I have some details to work out here. People like Mr. Upton and myself are always willing to go to any length to promote the career of budding artists. Trish, might I trouble you for another plate of cake?
There's no easy way to define unusual, except by contrasting it with what is usual. As a child, Gay Davidson-Zilski had no trouble telling the difference between what was ordinary and what wasn't, in the microcosm of her small hometown.
I was wasting time online with my brother Marx the other day, and the typing took a turn toward a familiar bogeyman of our youth, our little hometown's official drunk, also known as Steamer. Steamer's type is probably not unusual in the big world, but in a tiny, provincial, hard-working Midwestern wide spot in the road, he was the only apparently able-bodied adult male we children knew who didn't seem to have to work at a job. I think we envied him. At any rate, he has become a favorite subject when Marx and I are matching memories. "Do you remember Steamer digging a chicken leg out of our garbage can and eating it?" he wrote. Ever the one-upper, I asked how any edible material had actually survived our family's nine mouths to land in a garbage can. Then the whole scene magically, or tragically, presented itself. In my mind's eye, Steamer had to have been casing our house and must have grabbed the hunk of poultry almost before it landed, since my mother loved to torch things and set the trash barrel ablaze at least once a day. I can just see his bony hand snaking out of his ragged coverall sleeve and seizing the leg, wavering maybe a second if he spied pop bottles that could be redeemed for 2 cents each at Hegg's Grocery, a mere mile down the tracks as the fast freight flies. This last detail I believed to be one of the sources of Steamer's unusual moniker. Though there had been no steam trains running through our town for at least 50 years, my juvenile imagination put the big trains together with Steamer, who also rode the rails, quite literally. Being that the tracks were the fastest route between Steamer's shack and the town's only tavern, the Sportsman's Inn, Steamer took it. It was the express lane to Richard's Wild Irish Rose Wine, a ticket to paradise in a squat bottle. I never saw Steamer drive a car, the reasons for which are clear to me now, but the fact was an oddity to me then. Instead, he straddled an ancient rusty Schwinn, a girl's model, sort of blue, and with that wide center bar that we kids all call the gas tank. Behind the Schwinn, he had tied a similarly run-down rusty radio flyer coaster wagon. Steamer may have been a drunk, but he had excellent balance. There was no way any of my siblings or friends or I could have stayed upright while riding as slowly as Steamer did. Believe me, we tried. Plus, Steamer rode the ties between the rails of a very active Chicago Northwestern train route. We figured he must have deflated those fat balloon tires to nearly flat to cushion the bumpiness of those ties. In the wagon, he collected knee-high and Pepsi bottles, no matter how old and muddy, to cash in for booze, so he was a jiggling, lurching, clinking, crawling sight, making his daily creeps to Nirvana. Steamer had learned to maintain the same amount of grizzled stubble from day to day, and I'll never know whether he had hair, because he always wore a greasy, striped railroader's hat. Maybe he had worked on the rails once. A lot of guys stretched their income that way. There were always several rangy, beat-up cats insinuating themselves around the 10-by-12-foot shack. And in among the Alka-Seltzer cylinders on the cobwebby sill of his only window, a kid might sometimes spy one of his own plastic army men or tiny toy Indians. Of course, we kids were so terrified and fascinated, so attracted and repulsed, that nobody I know ever offered to go retrieve his lost toy. We didn't know alcoholism when we saw it, but we innocently admired the freedom of the outlaw life Steamer lived. He lived more like a kid than an adult, puttering around that cabin 50 yards from the tracks, 50 yards from our place. So we sneaked around, forbidden, of course, by all parents to go near his compound, and poked sweet spring grass through the wire to his rabbits, and tried to peer in that one grimy window when we thought he wasn't home. My parents felt sorry for Steamer, so they called him John when they caught themselves. They also discouraged sassiness in children, no matter which adult was being addressed, so we were told to call him John, too, which we never did. In fact, I can't recall ever speaking directly to him at all, and I hope I wasn't one who ever taunted him the way kids do. There must have been other people who looked out for Steamer in that small town, but if so, I didn't notice their contributions. I know my parents took the golden rule seriously, and Steamer was literally their neighbor. It was common knowledge that Steamer was the brother of one of the wealthiest women in town, but she had married up the short ladder of social success in that town, and was a solid church lady and had nothing to do with this embarrassing relative. My mother and father also knew cold and poverty, and they worried about Steamer. Certainly they would not have denied him a chicken leg, since my mother regularly had us drop off food baskets at a safe distance. It was on Christmas Day that this story ends. Early on, my folks noticed that there was no smoke rising from Steamer's wood-burner chimney. The stove itself had caused no little worry in the community. A drunk, a tinderbox cabin, a hot stove, rags, an accident waiting to happen. But in the frigid weather of December, no smoke was more alarming than smoke. Maybe his rich sister had relented on this Christmas morning. Maybe he had been taken in by some other citizen. My father returned from Steamer's later that day with that crease between his eyebrows a little deeper, which I felt was ominous. John's fire had not only gone out, but a series of fatal events must have occurred then. The exact cause of death was uncertain, but by the time Dad found him, the rats had already been there. His body was frozen as well, as faceless in death as he had been nameless in life. A harmless bogeyman, the guy kids scare each other with, and finally a mute statistic. Later on, The town bought the land his cabin stood upon and bulldozed it all, hutches, iron scraps, plum trees. So Steamer the Man became Steamer the Story. Sometimes, when I go down to visit my parents, I walk over and nose around the now bland site, trying to kick up my memories and some kind of meaning for it all. It's not that our steamer was unique. Winesburg, Ohio, Spoon River Anthology, Our Town, all their authors understood the pathetic nature of that character, the town drunk. But I hadn't yet read any great literature, and I couldn't imagine any other steamers. One of these days, I intend to ask Marx if he ever got the terrible details of Steamer's death out of our parents. If not, I think I'm going to keep this part of our story to myself. This is Gay Davidson-Zelsky, knowing that there but for the grace of God and good fortune go any of us, for Mind's Eye Radio.
When playwright Christian Uhouse, who some might consider out of the ordinary himself, heard that we were doing a show about unusual people and places, he went on an urban expedition. He retells his quest for the man who doesn't exist.
Is there anyone more unusual than a man who does not exist? Probably not, which is why I chose to interview the man who does not exist for this program. Few people have heard of the man who does not exist. His very non-existence seems to produce this effect. It was only by the merest chance that I knew that he can currently be found in Madison. My challenge was to find a more specific location and the man himself. An internet search revealed nothing. Newspaper advertisements? They brought only derision from the ignorant. I was in luck, however. I received an anonymous note, written in purple ink on a Bagels Forever receipt, indicating that my quarry could be found at the Concourse Hotel. Armed with this knowledge, I went to the hotel. To avoid arousing too much suspicion, I checked into the hotel and, in an offhand manner, casually inquired about the man who does not exist. Predictably, the front desk denied any knowledge. I didn't force the issue. I had a room in the hotel and was fairly confident I could cover my expenses with Mind's Eye grant money. If the man who does not exist was at the concourse, I would find him. Not that this search would be easy. The man who does not exist has no distinguishing habits and eats little. A notorious recluse, he can be virtually invisible when he wants to be. If I wanted to see him, I would have to make him come to me. It was not easy putting a note under every door in the hotel, but I was able to do so. I received many calls after this. Most were complaints. The rest were obvious false claims to be the man I was looking for. One person was audacious enough to say that there is no man who does not exist, but there is a woman who does not exist, and it was she who called. A hotel manager came by my room requesting an explanation. I told him the truth. A shrewd man, he neither affirmed nor denied the presence of the man who does not exist at the hotel, but suggested that if the man I sought did not contact me by tomorrow, I might want to consider looking elsewhere. Clearly, my current strategy was not working. But would any strategy work? Did the man who does not exist really have any reason for wanting to contact me? Even if he did contact me, how would I know? Wait a minute, I thought. Was it possible that the man who does not exist had already contacted me on a non-existent level? If he had, we certainly would have had a non-existent conversation. The more I thought about it, the more sense it made. It would only have been common courtesy for the man who does not exist to contact me, after all the effort I put into contacting him. Regrettably, one cannot capture a non-existent conversation on tape. I rely on your trust, dear listener, to believe me when I say that I had an encounter with the man who does not exist. A non-existent encounter, as only he would have it. This is Christian Uhouse, investigating for Mind's Eye Radio.
Coming up next on Mind's Eye Radio, we'll hear about a Wisconsin farmer who was also a famous astronomer and traveled the world from Patagonia to Chernobyl to Singapore. Stay with us, won't you? It's not too hard to find someone who carves wooden urns. nor is it unusual to find people with a physical disability. But combine the two, and you definitely have something out of the ordinary. Mark Karstedt found Oliver Bunno in his woodworking shop in Neenah, Wisconsin.
If you would have asked me in high school, I would be making cremation urns for the funeral industry, or even going legally blind, I think I would have laughed at you.
In his early 20s, Oliver Bunno lost his sight to retinitis pigmentosa, or RP, a condition that affects some 500,000 Americans. OJ has blind spots which prevent him from seeing the fine detail needed to read a newspaper or drive a car.
And I think the hardest thing that I ever had to give up was my driver's license.
OJ was diagnosed with RP before he completed a technical degree in woodworking. He found employers were unwilling to hire a legally blind woodworker, and since he needed to support his family, he started his own woodworking business, making wooden cremation urns.
The very first one that I did that started this whole idea off was when my brother passed away 6 years ago. It was quite an honor.
OJ puts a lot of love into the wood he works with. Because his blind spots change from day to day, he often misses the fine detail. Yet he can still appreciate the fingerprint left by nature.
You can see the beauty of the wood come through, and that's what I see as I'm working with the cremation urns. And I look at it as watching this piece evolve from just a block of wood to a work of art, and then watching the colors from the velvet oil just come alive.
Some of this passion for woodworking stems from his relationship with the Lord and his desire to help others.
It's a wonderful way to witness to people if they don't know the Lord in a time of mourning, because they can actually see, well, you know, life is very short, and that while we're here to know the Lord, it's an excellent way to plant a seed spiritually.
It's moving to watch OJ work on his lathe and caress the wood. He treats each piece with respect and admiration.
Your feeling of your hands is 10 times more acute than your eyesight.
Sometimes you'll find a large starburst on the side of the wood as you're turning it into an urn. The smell like olive wood when you're turning it. The shop smells like olives. Each one of them has its own characteristics as far as the colors that it will bring. Every single one of them is individual as just you and I.
OJ Bunno's attitude toward life is truly inspiring.
If you work at it and focus at a point on what you want to do with your life, the sky is the limit. I mean, you can do anything if you put your mind to it with the Lord.
OJ's urns can be found in art galleries and homes throughout the United States. To find out more, call Eternity Urns at 800-771-URNS. For Mind's Eye Radio, I'm Mark J. Karstedt in Neenah, Wisconsin.
You're going through your ordinary, everyday life when something stuns you with its unexpectedness. As writer Tacy Rozalowski discovered, that something can be as simple as a wooden hat and the man who makes them.
"But I want it. Do you think I should buy it?" He leaned forward earnestly. "No." His face fell, shoulders slumped. "But it's not my decision." She stuffed the checkbook in his shirt pocket. "Make up your mind. The meter's running on the babysitter." I overheard this conversation at the American Crafts Exposition in Evanston, Illinois. When Betsy went off to phone the kids, I discovered that Wayne was trying to decide whether to buy a $1,200 wooden hat. Wayne already had two other wooden hats, bought at previous shows. He loves to wear them. They always attract attention, but this one was the best of all. "How about giving me a second opinion?" he suggested, and we set off for the booth. I can understand his agony. It was a terrific hat, and that's how I met the only creator of wooden hats in America, Johannes Michelsen. Michelsen's a sexy man. His rugged good looks say he's worked hard, been around the block a few times, and enjoyed a good part of the trip. He's a pleasant flirt, handy with a one-liner, too, and he exudes an infectious sense of play, especially when he talks about his hats. He was wearing a Range Rider that day. It's the most Western-looking of his hats. He looks good in it. Hell, he'd look good in any hat. Michelson admits he has a hat fetish, and his hats really are something special. Michelson uses yellow birch, sugar maple, black cherry, white oak, butternut, all the hardwoods available in the Green Mountains of Vermont, where he's lived for years. In the 70s, he worked as a developer and carpenter. With a specialty in custom-built staircases, he's a master at working wood on a lathe and by hand. 10 years ago, these skills met up with his hat fetish. He made his first wooden hat on a whim, as a joke. It was a terrible hat, he said, but it was the beginning of a new career. Today, he's sold over 600 wooden hats. It's no joke anymore. Michelson makes micro hats that fit on your fingertip. He makes mini hats for playful display. He makes women's hats, but men buy most of his hats, to display as sculpture or to wear. Wayne told me his hats all fit very comfortably. Custom hats are made to measure. Others are fit to the head with little pads, but they all begin with an idea for a shape of a hat and a single chunk of green wood. With a chainsaw and a bandsaw, Michelson removes excess wood. He uses a lathe to sculpt a thin, lofty crown and define the basic shape of the brim. He took off his Range Rider to explain the process. The Range Rider is the shapeliest of his styles. He ran his hands over the hat to show me how the brim dips down in front, scoops up on the sides, and plunges down again in back. You can coax green wood into shapes like that, then dry it so it stays. Michelson used the wood grain perfectly to accentuate the curves. I almost forgot the hat was made from something hard. To complete the illusion, Michelson sands and lacquers the surface 10 times. The wood glows, soft and glossy. It takes days to finish one hat. This is a gift of nature, he said, and pointed to a bit of bark on the side of the crown. It looked just like a little feather. Hats really are seductive. I love to look at a man in a hat. And not a ball cap, please. I mean a proper hat. If the Blues Brothers hadn't been wearing hats, would anyone have believed they were on a mission from God? How about Clint Eastwood's hats, to accentuate those calculating eyes, the unwavering cool? For Michelson, a hat provides an essential finishing touch. Zip up your fly, put on your hat, he quipped. When he worked construction, he'd show up at a site in his Ford pickup truck with a white Western-style hat and his plans under his arm. No one in Vermont wore hats like that, but it was my costume, he said. I had to wear it. A man in a hat doesn't just show up, he makes an appearance. Michelson blames automobiles and JFK for the death of the hat. In an automobile, he says, you don't need anything to cover your head. And JFK was the first president to be inaugurated without a hat. Suddenly, bare heads were okay. What a loss. Johannes Michelson's hats certainly get my imagination working. The sensual curves beg to be touched, and then you remove the hat and run your hands through the guy's hair. Maybe those wooden hats are even a metaphor for something else, like the ideal man, durable, hard, with subtlety, and a sensual softness as well. You remember the old story about the oak and the palm tree. A man's got to know when to bend with the wind. Wayne told me that wooden hats are very functional. When it rains, the brim works like a gutter. But Michelson sums it up best. It's just sexy. I'm pleased to report Wayne bought his hat. I'm Tacy Rosolowski for Mind's Eye Radio.
Oftentimes, what makes someone out of the ordinary is their dedication to fulfilling an unlikely dream. Writer Paul Thompson discovered one such person in The Boy Astronomer of Cottage Grove.
This is a story, a true story, about a poor Wisconsin farm boy who loved to explore the night sky and yearned to become an astronomer. His dream didn't come true. But John Mellish did leave his name inscribed in the pages of American astronomy. Let me tell you how. John was born in 1884 on a farm in the township of Cottage Grove, near the city of Madison. It wasn't much of a farm, a hard scrabble 40 acres. Like most farm boys of his generation, John left school after the eighth grade, and he seemed destined to a life behind the plow. But he had a great deal of natural curiosity and became a bird watcher. When he was 16, he bought, or was given, a small spyglass for watching birds. He turned it on the night sky, and a new interest was born, stargazing. John began to read everything he could find about astronomy, optics, and mathematics. By helping out his uncle, who was a carpenter, he scraped together cash to buy a real telescope, a 2-inch refractor. His new instrument revealed a host of new stars, and he was a happy boy, but still not satisfied. So he spent a winter grinding the glass mirror he needed to build a 6-inch reflector. That experience led to another turn in John's life. He wrote an article for Popular Mechanics on telescope making, and this generated a modest sideline business of building telescopes for others. He became as familiar with the heavens as with the footpaths and fields of the farm, and he was wonderfully sharp-sighted. One evening, in the spring of 1907, when John was 21, he spotted a faint new object, like a tiny wisp of smoke, in the northern sky. He notified the College Observatory in Madison, and that's how he became the co-discoverer of Comet Grigg-Mellish. He capped his discovery that fall by finding another new comet. This time, his name alone was attached to it. The discoveries brought national attention to the boy astronomer of Cottage Grove, as the local newspaper called him. The Astronomical Society of Mexico awarded him a gold medal. He dreamed of becoming a professional astronomer. But the hard reality was there were few paid positions in the field. And although he had discovered two comets, John had no academic credentials. For the next 8 years, he remained a farmer and telescope maker. He built himself progressively larger instruments, but he had discouragingly little time for actually observing the sky. He did strike up a correspondence with the director of Yerkes Observatory near Chicago, and when John discovered a third comet in 1915, the scientist urged him to come to Yerkes, but as a volunteer observer with no pay. John decided it wasn't financially possible. The director didn't give up. He considered this young man an observational genius. He managed to get John a $300 grant and persuaded him to leave the farm and come to Yerkes as an observer for as long as he could make the money last. John arrived at Yerkes for a 15-month stay. It was one more unexpected turn in John's life, and almost immediately his life changed again. He read an ad placed by a young Chicago-area woman looking for the perfect man. Out of 2,000 replies, his letter appealed to her the most, and when she met him, John turned out to be a handsome, if somewhat rough-cut, young man. Within 2 months, they were married. Oh, and he discovered another comet. Well, how does this story turn out? John wasn't able to parlay his stay at Yerkes into an astronomical career, but he didn't return to the farm either. He went on to become one of America's finest makers of small and medium-sized telescopes. And there's one more twist to the story. While John was at Yerkes, he spent considerable time studying Mars through the observatory's main telescope. In early November of 1913, the position of the planet and the viewing conditions were ideal for detecting surface details. And remember, John had razor-sharp vision. He saw and sketched what no one had previously reported, several lunar-type craters on Mars. To John's disappointment, most astronomers dismissed his observations. Scientists argued about whether Mars had canals, but nobody thought there were craters. His observations were forgotten. But many years later, in 1964, the Mariner 4 spacecraft passed close to Mars to take 22 photographs of the surface. And John, by then retired and in his 70s, was vindicated. The photos revealed that Mars, indeed, was cratered. This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
What's ordinary? What's extraordinary? Writer Charlotte Quo Benitez, who was raised in Singapore but now makes her home in the United States, thinks it's all a matter of where you're standing.
Singapore? That's somewhere in China, right? When I tell people that I grew up in Singapore, I often receive one of two reactions, the ignorant and the over-informed. The ignorance usually comes in geographical form. Once, when I mentioned to someone that I was from Singapore, she proceeded to tell me about a book she'd just read on political prisoners in China. The book turned out to be Life and Death in Shanghai, not Singapore. Singapore is, as a matter of fact, not a part of China. Unlike Hong Kong and Taiwan, it never has been and probably never will be. It is a tiny independent nation in the South China Sea, situated just 1 degree from the equator, and its closest neighbors are Malaysia and Indonesia. Of the 3 million ethnically Chinese, Malay, and Indian Singaporeans who live on the island, almost 3/4 are Chinese. Therein lies the source of the confusion. To make matters worse, besides being multicultural, Singapore is also multilingual. The 4 national languages are Chinese, Malay, Tamil, and English. But the dominant language, the language of instruction in schools and the official language for trade and commerce, is English. Like most people in the world, Singaporeans are bilingual, at the very least. The over-informed person is often a scholar or a keen observer of global politics. Upon hearing about my unique background, he or she fixes me with an intense look, leans forward, and says with raised eyebrows, "So, how do you feel about the human rights situation in Singapore?" They are referring to Singapore's various and notorious laws, which range from the really repressive to the sublimely stupid. In Singapore, one needs a license to speak in a public venue. Oppositional political parties are muzzled, and the so-called independent media is heavily regulated by the government. And of course, everybody knows about the ban on chewing gum and the fines levied for spitting and littering in public. The over-informed person usually knows more about the latest fine laws than I do, and is eager to hear from a native informant. Now don't get me wrong, I have as much to say about Singaporean politics as the next concerned person, and, depending on whether or not I like who I'm speaking to, I may throw in some of my own favorites, such as a special State Department called the Social Development Unit, or SDU, whose job is to matchmake young Singaporeans of similar educational and socioeconomic backgrounds. Among other things the government likes a hand in is who gets to procreate with whom. When rude cynics labeled the SDU a pathetic measure for the single, desperate, and ugly, government propaganda quickly spread that the SDU was in fact catering to the single, desirable, and unattached. By all accounts, the SDU has had an impressive success rate. People are often delighted when I partake in some light Singapore bashing, and sometimes I am happy to oblige. The problem arises when my conversation partner, so eager to hear about all the negative stuff, shows an equal lack of interest in hearing the positive side of living in Singapore. The fact is that a large majority of Singaporeans are middle class, own their own home, and have a stable family life. Children worry about grades, not about drugs, sex, or guns. That doesn't mean there is no political apathy, poverty, racial tension, or violent crime. But given the way these plague America, I often get the distinctive feeling of rocks being thrown from glass houses. I have lived in America now for 10 years, survived 10 freezing winters, yet most of my friends in Singapore have never seen snow. After 10 years, seasonal changes still take me by surprise. But I am now equally surprised stepping out of the Changi Airport and into the constant heat and humidity of Singapore. Even the breezes here are warm. I didn't understand until I was much older how unusual it is to live in a city where the air and water everywhere is always clean and where it is green all year round. I now appreciate in a way I never did growing up Singapore's tree-lined streets and innumerable parks, the way its lush greenness never dies. When I tell someone in Singapore that I live in a place called Madison, Wisconsin, in the United States, I often get the following response. Madison? Madison what, huh? Oh, that's somewhere in New York, right? This is Charlotte Kuo Benitez for Mind's Eye Radio.
As we all know, the world is shrinking thanks to modern technology. But there are still a few places that are out of the way and out of the ordinary, such as the far southeast corner of South America. Here's poet Esther Cameron with her poem, Patagonia.
Some months ago, I saw a television program on Patagonia. The landscape it showed was essentially a moonscape with some gray-green grass, scrub trees, and a high wind. It looked lonely for good reason. However, the narrator stated that Patagonia has become the latest place for wealthy Americans to buy ranches. This impression inspired the following poem, which is also a takeoff on a poem by Goethe that was a sentimental favorite in the 19th century. Patagonia. Know'st thou the region of this hemisphere, where still the air is fresh, the water clear, where yet the affluent spirit can breathe free, unchecked by too much human company? Know'st thou that land? Then, dear one, come away. Here is the ground where such as we might play. No freeway mars the land with ugly curves, nor jet plane booming overhead unnerves. No fast food billboards cheapen the roadside. No sleuth observes us, nor reporters snide. Know'st thou that land? Then, dear one, come away. There is the place for presidents at bay. In deep-notched vale amid the desert plains, no neighbor's voice disturbs us nor complains. No speedboat tears the shining lake save ours. No sight of urban poor the prospect sours. To Patagonia, dear one, come away. There is no retreat left in the USA. I'm Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
Human influence can take what is common about a place and twist and alter it beyond all human recognition. Poet Sharon Van Sluice tells of such catastrophe in her poem After Chernobyl, Sailing South.
In late April of 1986, the graphite-fired nuclear power plant at Chernobyl in the Western Soviet Union melted down, spewing out an enormous radioactive cloud of steam. This poem takes place at that time on a boat nearby in the Adriatic Sea, the waters between Italy and what was then Yugoslavia. After Chernobyl, sailing south. Your touch is light on the short band, tuning. The BBC chips through and all is changed. Soon the markets will buzz like gnats. At Pasici, we pack the galley, more than a week in mind. This Adriatic breeze turns precious, the current a blessing. We trim the mainsail, cut all luffing, hold a close reach for speed maintained. 5 knots urged to 6 is a day saved. All day we sail south toward the Strait of Otranto, all day spelling and shifting, you and I. We eat light as mice. We breathe this air carefully. What is this air? How quick we recall what we know in our bones, the terror, the wonders of the invisible world. We listen again. Again the news stings us. There is little to say. Hazard of fate, it is the same. We are tiny. We sail on into the shroud of night, sleeping by turns, spelling and shifting south to the Greek island necklace, south to the sacred and simple past. Above the coming cesium fireflies, the million stars shine impassive and ancient, old as this fear and this knowing in our hearts that some Moses, arisen, bereft, insane, ranting, has coaxed from him one more plague in earnest.
That was Madison poet Sharon Van Sluis. Just because something is ordinary doesn't make it good or desirable. But changing the habits and behavior that makes something an ordinary part of our life can be especially challenging, as essayist Fran Zell tells in Dancing with Maniacs.
Maybe what's unusual is not that there are so many maniacs in the world, but that I've had an affinity for them. I have dined with them, lived with them. Yes, I confess, even slept with them. Over the years, I have let maniacs into my life, nurtured and coddled them like so many subatomic hothouse plants destined to spew radioactive funnel clouds over us both. "You're controlling," the last maniac said about 2 months into the relationship. "You didn't want to have sex last night. That means it's always going to be your decision when we have sex. It means we're never going to have sex again, and we have to have sex. My last girlfriend and I fought all the time, but we had wonderful sex." "You need a therapist," the last maniac said, after I'd informed her that she needed one. I've had therapists. I've spent oodles of money on therapists. Graduated not to the point where I am cured, but to where I have many friends who are therapists. I called one of these friends. Less than 10 minutes into my mournful description of what had been going on, she said, "This sounds abusive, Fran. You need to get out of it." The trouble is, I loved the maniac. She was my sister all over again. The wounded sister I loved, who hates and resents me to this day, because our parents rejected her in favor of me, the properly frightened and obedient child. Our parents treated my sister miserably. They ridiculed her friends, her aspirations and abilities, tossed her out of the nest like a bird with the wrong color feathers. There's a part of me that has always felt responsible for my sister's pain, a part of me that has been willing to play sponge to her inconsolable anger and grief. A part of me that clung to the girlfriend, hoping that each angry, irrational outburst would be her last, hoping that she would change. It didn't surprise me that the maniac I loved told me stories about a maniacal father who cooked the pet duck and made the family eat it, who punched her in the face when she was little because she tried to stop a violent fight between him and her mother. Maybe you know the drill. She's a maniac, but she's my maniac. Maybe I'm not so unusual in my affinity for craziness, since we all know the world is boiling over with it. What's unusual is the place where I'm living now, realizing that I don't want destructive energy in my life anymore, that I don't have to be maniac enough to believe I've done anything to warrant it. I can walk away from the relationship and be her friend or not be her friend as I choose. I'm not clinging to my grief or my pain or my denial that it's over. That's really unusual. Maybe, oh just maybe, this will be my last maniac. This is Fran Zell, dancing to a different drummer for Mind's Eye Radio.
You've been listening to Out of the Ordinary, written by members of the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Sue Renard. Contributing writers include Esther Cameron, Gay Davidson-Zilski, Mark Karstedt, Charlotte Quo Benitez, Christian Newhouse, Sue Renard, Tacy Rosolowski, Paul Thompson, Sharon Van Sluis, Lynn Patrick Smith, Kelly Warren, and Fran Zell. Thanks to excerpts of Exploring the Mind of an Artist, written by Rob Ferret. Actors include Dave Cherney, Kathy Kaufman, Ed Mish, and Greg Willard. Original music by Barbara Chusett. If you would like a cassette copy of this show, or would like more information about Mind's Eye Radio, call 608-256-6525. And wishing you an extraordinary day, I'm Cole Hornaday from Mind's Eye Radio.